This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. Imagine a world without work. What happens when machines take over and jobs disappear within a few decades? We explore this potentially terrifying scenario with Dr. Daniel Susskind, a fellow in economics at Balliol College, Oxford University, and author of two books, A World Without Work and The Future of the Professions. Thank you for joining us, and I hope things are all right for you in the UK. Technological changes are accelerating, and they're going to change our lives in quite a profound way. What surprised you when you were writing and researching for your books?
I just think every day we hear stories of systems and machines taking on tasks we thought only human beings alone could ever do. Driving a car, making a medical diagnosis, drafting legal contracts, designing beautiful buildings, composing news reports, writing beautiful music. And what does all of this mean for the vast majority of us for whom our jobs are our main source of income? And I wrote A World Without Work because I just don't think we're taking seriously enough the threat of a world where there's not enough well-paid work for people to do because of the advances of these new technologies. And alongside the remarkable technological progress that we see taking place, that was, I think, quite surprising. It's worth saying, I don't think there's going to be some dramatic big bang in the next few years after which everyone wakes up and find themselves without work. That's not going to happen. Work is going to remain for some time to come. But what I do worry about is that as we move through the 21st century, more and more people might find that they're unable, because of these technological progress, they find they're unable to make the sorts of economic contributions to society that they might have hoped or expected to make in the 20th century. And that is, I think, a great challenge to the way that we currently live together.
So it seems to me the challenge is our mindset, our expectations, our complacency.
Partly it's a challenge about mindset. I mean, in the book, I actually set out three different challenges, the three sort of concrete challenges that I think we'll face. One is the challenge of inequality. It's not a coincidence that today worries about economic inequality are intensifying at exactly the same time that worries about inequality are growing. The two problems are very closely related. You know, today, the labor market is the main way that we share our income in society. You know, for most people, their job is their main, if not their only, source of income. And so, you know, the inequality that we see around us today shows that this approach is already creaking. You know, some people get far more for their work than others. Technological unemployment, which is what I'm fascinated by, is simply a more extreme version of that story, but one that ends with some people receiving nothing at all. And so for me, the challenge, the economic challenge we're going to face in a world with less work is a challenge of inequality. It's a challenge of how do we share out prosperity in society when our traditional way of doing so, paying people for the work that they do, is less effective than it might have been in the past. But it's not just challenges of the economic challenge of inequality. I think there's also two other big challenges. One is the challenge of power. What we do about the growing power, and in particular, the growing political power of the large technology companies who are increasingly responsible for developing these technologies in the first place. And then the third is the challenge of meaning and purpose. You know, for many people, work is not simply a source of income, but it's also a source of meaning and purpose and direction and structure in life as well. And so the challenge of a world with less work isn't just a challenge of a world with perhaps less income, but it's also a challenge, perhaps, of a world with less meaning and purpose, too. And that, I think, is another very significant challenge.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about income inequality. And if I may, I'll take a more macro and global view. Countries like Malaysia, we are emerging, but almost going to be developed status. And we are very dependent on export revenue and foreign direct investments to grow our economy and raise income levels. If jobs can be automated away in developed markets where most of our goods go to, what happens to global trade and labour mobility?
if we solve the challenge of inequality, if we find other ways to provide people with an income other than through the work that they do, then there'll be plenty of demand around the world. Far more troubling for thinking about the sort of economic model that you've just described is what's taking place at the moment with the pandemic. That, you know, one of the major consequences of this pandemic, I think, is going to be a slowdown in many dimensions of globalization, not simply the free movement of goods and services, but also, of course, the free movement of people.
How should governments like emerging markets, how should they start to rethink about welfare and wealth distribution and economic models of growth?
In the book, I distinguish between two different types of technological unemployment. The first is what I call frictional technological unemployment. And here, there's plenty of work to be done. The challenge is that for various reasons, people aren't able to take up that work. There's then a second challenge, which is structural technological unemployment. And this is, I think, a far more troubling proposition. And this is where there's not enough work to be done, full stop. Now, the reason that distinction is important is because I think for now, the main challenge that most countries around the world are going to face is the frictional challenge. There is going to be work to be done, but for various reasons, people might not be able to take up that work. And so if we're thinking about what we ought to do now, what we ought to do is deal with this problem of frictional technological unemployment. And there's various reasons why I think that frictional technological unemployment is a threat. One is what I call the skills mismatch, where, you know, people just simply don't have the skills and capabilities that are required to do the new types of jobs that have to be done. And so the response we need to that is the familiar one, which is we need to focus on our education system. But there's also, I think, quite an interesting problem, which is the identity mismatch, where people have a particular conception of themselves and they're willing to stay unemployed in order to protect that identity. So think of men of working age in the United States displaced from manufacturing roles by new technologies. There are some that say some of these people would rather not work at all than take up, and it's a really unfortunate term, take up so-called pink collar work. But the term is designed to capture the fact that many of the jobs that are hardest to automate and where there's a lot of job growth are disproportionately done by women. So jobs like preschool and kindergarten teaching or nursing or social work. So it's not obvious to me that education can necessarily help us with respect to those latter two mismatches.
So it's also a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Governments, for example, they can subsidize training, which is done also in Malaysia and I'm sure in the UK as well. The jobs have to be created in order for people to practice those skills. And sometimes I find that, you know, employers have to make that investments too. So what are your thoughts about this?
This question of how do we pay? It's all very well saying we need more education, but how do we pay for it? That, I think, is, you know, a really important. It's a difficult question. And I think the answer is that financial burden has to fall on three different groups. One is, as you say, the employer. The other, though, is also the state. The state has a role as well. But I also think the individual, too, has to contribute as well. And finding the right balance between these three different actors in thinking about how we finance education and training, particularly later in life, particularly when it comes to retraining and re-education and reskilling later in life. What's been quite interesting in the last few years is that there's been quite a lot of innovation in thinking about how we can support individuals in financing their education. So one example, a company called Lambda School in the United States. It's a computer science program, a computer science degree, and there is no cost up front to the individual taking the degree. Instead, they only pay back once they get a job that pays above a certain level. So it's a way, in a sense, of borrowing against your future income that's going to come from getting this degree. And I just point that out because that's, you know, quite an interesting innovation in thinking about personal finance. And it's the sort of thing that we need to be embracing and exploring if we're going to solve this financing challenge, which, as you correctly identify, I think is one of the most significant challenges, particularly when thinking about education later in life.
This morning, I'm speaking to Dr. Daniel Susskind, a fellow in economics at Balliol College, Oxford University, and author of A World Without Work. We'll discuss the role of the big state and how to curb big tech companies. Keep it here.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. Dr. Daniel Susskind, a fellow in economics at Balliol College, Oxford University, and author of two books, one of them being A World Without Work, joins me today. You're calling for the government to play a bigger role in addressing issues that are going to arise when machines start to replace people. However, governments and regulations seldom keep pace with innovation. So how do you ensure governments will not end up being an obstacle to realizing the full potential of technology while preparing people for an uncertain future?
What's been quite interesting, I think, is looking at what we've seen being done by governments around the world in response to this pandemic. You know, we find ourselves today in a world with less work, not because robots took all the jobs, but because this virus, COVID-19, has just completely decimated the demand that so many jobs rely upon. And so we find ourselves facing exactly the sorts of challenges that I wrote about in the book. How do we share our income in society when our traditional way of doing so, paying people for the work that they do, is less effective? You know, many people are in lockdown and unable to work. The demand for many types of work has just been decimated. The supply of many types of work has been constrained, as I said, because of these lockdowns. How do we do it? What we've seen around the world is the state, exactly as I call for in the book, stepping forward to take a larger role in sharing our prosperity in society. So in the UK, for instance, at the moment, the British government is paying up to 80% of the wages of, I think at the moment, it's about 8 million workers in the UK, which is, you know, an extraordinarily large proportion of the UK labour market. And it's the sort of intervention that would have been unimaginable a few months ago. And yet it's precisely the sort of boldness that I think we'll need from the state in responding to the challenges created by a world with less work. As you say, though, there is a sense in which much of our regulatory environment was designed, you know, for the 20th century, and we need a 21st century regulatory environment, institutional environment that supports and encourages the sorts of innovations that I've been describing.
What sort of models would you be looking at, like a conditional basic income, universal basic income, or a greater social protection net?
In the book, I'm actually quite skeptical of the idea of a universal basic income. I'm less concerned about the idea of a basic income, the idea that there is some income that is given to everyone, whoever they are, independent of their labour market status, whether they're in or outside of work. What worries me more is the universal part of it, that it's given to everyone with no conditions attached. And what I write about in the book and what I conceive of in the book is not a universal basic income, but a conditional basic income, an income that does come with conditions attached.
What sort of conditions would you be looking at?
Social solidarity comes from a sense that everybody is pulling their economic weight in society. You know, that everyone is paying into the collective pot through the work that they do and the taxes that they pay. And you know, if people aren't in work, there's an expectation that they, if they're able to, that they actively look for work. A universal basic income where some people get an income, whatever they do, I think undermines that sense of social solidarity, a feeling that everybody is pulling their economic weight. The challenge, though, is that in a world with less work, there might not be opportunities for people to work and to pull their economic weight. And so what I write about in the book is, well, we've got to, as a society, try and devise a set of non-economic contributions that people might be able to make to society, other ways that people might be able to pay into the collective pot, and that any basic income could be conditional on doing those sorts of socially useful activities instead. So, yeah, that might sound relatively fanciful, but, you know, take the UK volunteering sector, for instance. You know, millions of people already do lots of socially valuable work that doesn't necessarily receive a wage in return. The Andy Haldane, who's the chief economist at the Bank of England, estimated that this sector is worth about 50 billion pounds. So just to put that in context, that's about the size of the entire UK energy sector. Incredibly valuable work, socially valuable. It's the sort of thing that we might recognise, that we might make a basic income conditional on.
In order to fund a basic income or a conditional basic income, governments will have to figure out how to either tax some revenue. And where do you foresee this money is going to come? Will it be about taxing technological capital?
The short answer to that question is, well, what we need to do is we need to tax the various types of capital in the economy that are becoming more valuable. And some of that might be human capital, in the sense that there's probably going to be some individuals whose skills and capabilities are very valuable in because of technological progress. They happen to do skill, they happen to perform tasks that technological progress makes more valuable, more important. And so we might want to tax those people more because their human capital is worth more. But we also will want to tax traditional capital as well. And that's not just factories, those who own factories and those who own equipment, but it's the sort of, you know, capital that that drives, you know, more modern economies. Those who own intellectual property, those on different types of software or technology or whatever it may be. But the basic principle is that we need to tax those people who own whatever capital it is that becomes more valuable. As we move into this world with less work, and we need to share it with those who don't have capital that's particularly valuable.
You also talked about curbing the role of big tech companies because they are becoming more influential, especially and they're having more political power. What do you have in mind? I mean, a simplistic argument maybe to break them up.
In the 21st century, though, I think our concerns are going to be far more about the political power of large companies, and in particular, large technology companies, and not about things like profit and price, but instead the impact that these technology companies have on things like liberty, democracy, and social justice. You know, take one example, Facebook, for instance. You know, in part, people today are worried about their extraordinary profitability, but more and more people are worried about their political power, their impact that they have on the sort of on the way in which we all live together in society. That in 2016, for instance, it said that, you know, Russia were able to buy or able to influence the US election through Facebook. And those are the sorts of concerns that I think are going to become more and more prominent, concerns about political power rather than economic power. So what I think we need is an institution which is, you know, analogous to a competition authority or an antitrust authority, which might traditionally look at abuses of economic power. And instead, we need an institution which is concerned with political power. And that institution, and it might sound like I'm shooting myself in the foot saying this as an economist, but it ought not to be staffed by economists. You know, economists might have very good tools for thinking about things like prices and profits, but they're not very useful for thinking about ideas like liberty, democracy, social justice, and whether or not they're under threat. So I think we need a new type of institution, similar in structure and similar in power to a competition authority or an antitrust authority, but instead focused on issues of political power and abuse of that political power.
I know the immediate concern is frictional unemployment. Going further ahead would be structural unemployment. And I wonder what would be the role of top universities like Oxford? How might they need to change to, you know, continue to be on the forefront, to chart the future, and especially when new knowledge will be created in a much more decentralized way thanks to technology?
How we teach, you know, if you were to jump in a time machine and travel back 100 years, as many people have noted, lecture theatres or classrooms or tutorial rooms back then would have looked remarkably similar to how they look today. The way in which we teach people hasn't changed much at all in the last few decades. One of the consequences of the pandemic has been that the education system has been thrust into a sort of massive unplanned pilot scheme in the use of technology in education. And I hope that the education system as a whole is able to, as we might do with a traditional pilot, learn the lessons of what works and what doesn't, so that we're able to reform not just what we teach, but also how we teach. There's then a final part to the education challenge, which is when we teach. I think there is a prevailing sort of cultural view that education is the sort of thing that you do at the start of your life. That's when you do it. That's when you spend the time, the effort. I think that's a great mistake. You know, there is inevitably a great deal of uncertainty about what skills and what capabilities are going to be valuable in the future. I have a go in my work, The Future of the Professions in a World Without Work, at trying to explore what those skills and capabilities might be. But inevitably, there's a huge amount of uncertainty about the future. And the best response to that uncertainty is flexibility, a willingness to retrain and reskill and re-educate yourself throughout your life with the same sort of intensity and seriousness that you might have engaged with it at the start of your life.
You have a young daughter. How would you prepare her for jobs that don't exist yet?
I think about this a lot because of her. You know, what's the world going to look like when she emerges into the world of work? I mean, for now, she's so young that I just want her to be as happy as she can be. I just try and find out what she's interested in and nurture and encourage that. You know, if she's to succeed in the world of work, either she needs to do the sorts of things that these systems and machines cannot do, or she ought to become the sort of person who's capable of designing and building these systems and machines. And if I was pushed to choose a path, or to, you know, if I was asked to advise her on a path, I would say that second one is probably the more fun and the more interesting and the more exciting, because if these systems and machines are just going to become more powerful, more capable over time, as inevitably I think they're going to, then being the sort of person who can design and build them just seems to me such a sort of thrilling and exciting and rewarding path to take.
All the best to her, and thanks for your time. Dr. Daniel Susskind, a fellow in economics at Oxford University and author of A World Without Work. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.